people who sent me emails. I understand that half of you are math majors, so I apologize for math jokes. But I'll have more for you, don't worry. And then if you still want to be on the email list and you haven't sent me an email, you still can do that. And I just ask that you briefly answer why you are taking this particular class, and also what's your physics background. Okay, and what I'd like to discuss with you now is actually sort of a 10-minute introduction into what's sometimes called higher calculus, you know, the derivatives and integrals. And this is sort of an essential thing for this course, and it's very simple, as you will see. I think more than half of you probably know already everything about it. So let's say we are considering a motion along one axis. So I don't want to bother with vectors for just now, and if we're describing the motion along one axis, we just can use scalars, right, just the coordinate. So let's call this x, and let's say that this is the zero. This could be some stretch of a highway, and actually, even if the highway is not straight, but it's bending, we can still sort of straighten it in our mind and say, okay, this is the direction. So in fact, the arrow may be very curvy, the axis, but then we can you know, don't need to bother about it if we stick to the road, if we don't go off the road. And then we can ask some sort of a question. Let's say we have a car, at t equal to zero, the position of the car was x zero, which could be the city of Auckland or whatever you want. Okay, and then we know that somebody got into the driver's seat and then drove off first slowly and then accelerated, then decided to stop at the traffic light, you know, which you should do is a good idea, and then, you know. And so if we draw the speed of the car we always draw what's called the independent variable, in this case time, on the horizontal axis and the dependent variable on the vertical axis, like this. So let's say this is t0, you know, some initial moment in time. And let's say that the car was parked, and then, you know, we got in the driver's seat and gradually started accelerating, then reached the speed limit, you know, drove for a while, and then saw the red traffic light, you know, stopped. In mathematics, we can have discontinuous graphs, but in physics, we usually connect things together because you can't be moving with a finite speed and then instantaneously stop. But you can have some approximation of the discontinuity. So this is like you hit the brakes and then you stop. And then, so you stay on the traffic light for a while. Okay, then the traffic light turned green, and there was another car next to you, and you decided to do a little race, and so you actually accelerate very fast and go faster, and then there is a cop. I mean, they can have all kinds of scenarios about this. So, I mean, it's pretty much arbitrary. Then you can decide that you forgot your backpack and you turn around, right? So in that case, what might happen, you might stop and actually turn around and go back like that, right? So this could be negative as well, which means that you would be moving in that direction, right? So it's... And then we can ask, okay, this is the velocity as a function of time, okay? And say I started at t equal to zero and then I ended at some time t star, but here. So I might ask a question. So where am I given I was at x zero at time t zero? This is called an initial condition, where I was at the initial moment of time. And the evolution v of t given by this function. Okay? Well, in order to address that, we can do the following. Well, let's say, for the simplest case, we are here moving with a constant speed. Right? We're moving at a constant speed. So if we are here at some instant of time, then in the next instant of time, so we have x of t, let's say, right? And then in the next instant of time, which I call x t plus delta t, we are just where we were before, plus our constant speed, v, right, times delta t. Yes? Right? The v is in meters per second. This is the small interval of time. This is how far you travel. So if I draw this in here, so this coordinate, this height here is v, and this is my delta t. So this tells me where I was in the beginning of this interval, and this is how much I travel, this v delta t. Well, let's see what it means graphically here. This is v, this is delta t. What is v times delta t? Yeah, what is it geometrically here? Yeah, this is the area. Right? Now, what if I considered an interval of time where the speed was not constant? It's this interval. So you can see the speed clearly changes in here. So how can I estimate how much I move? Well, it's not constant, but I say, I'll just approximate it as being constant. You know, this is not going to be really a very good approximation if the interval is large, but if the interval is small, I just neglect the change over there. And I can say that from here to here, it traveled like that. See, and this little triangle here is my error, but the smaller my time interval dt, the smaller that error will be. And if I want to do the next interval here, I'm going to jump. I'm going to say that my velocity here is that. And this will be my travel in the next interval. And, you know, the smaller dt I make, the more faithful representation this sort of an approximation makes to the actual area. So what I'm trying to say is the following. First thing is that distance traveled, and by the way, I hope some of you give me instant feedback and discussion. You can you should feel free to protest if you don't like what you hear. So distance traveled is the area under the curve sorry. Okay. And the second thing I'm trying to say is that the area can be approximated by considering V of t constant for small intervals delta t. So that's what I've drawn here. We just have these little steps and consider velocity constant. And then I'm saying that this sort of a crude approach gets better and better as our interval dt gets smaller and smaller. And in fact, you can prove this mathematically provided the function has all the right mathematical properties. And in physics, most of functions are smooth. So physics has very little issue with things like that. And then I should tell you the mathematical notation for this. The mathematical notation, let me say that this is item number 3. In mathematical language, we can say that x of t the position at time t is given by the position at some initial time t naught plus. So this area business that I just described to you is denoted mathematically as an integral. And the integral is taken from the initial time t naught to the time we're interested in, t, of v. Now, let me write it and then I'll comment on it. V of t prime times dt prime. D of t prime, yes. So this should be on, maybe I should move it so this is the first time I'm writing this. So this thing is called the integral, this sort of a funny looking curvy thing, and it goes from t0 to t. T is the time when we're measuring the position, then v of t prime, and then dt prime. Okay, this is called the definite integral. And let me ask you a question. Those of you who have not seen, or probably all of you have seen this, of course, before, but who has not studied this in some detail yet? Okay. Okay, so if it gets difficult for you, make an appointment with me and come to my office. I'll go over that again. So all this thing, all this fancy notation says is that this is just the area under the curve of V. So the one way of thinking about this, this curvy business, you can think of sort of a stylized letter S which would indicate the sum. You can think of it as sum of little pieces, v of t prime dt prime. So the only reason we have t prime here is because the letter t is already reserved for the upper limit of the integral. So we call this the variable of integration, but the meaning of it is the time still. And these little pieces, v of t prime dt prime, are just these things, these increments, okay, these elements of area. And then this thing is just the sum over them, and it's called the integral because it's the sum in the limit of delta t being very small. And the limit of delta t being very small is denoted like this, dt. Okay? And so it's just initial position plus the sum of these increments and small increments of time. So it's actually all very natural. Okay? Questions? This thing is called definite integral. So, no questions means either it's all very clear or all very confusing. Let's take a vote. Who says it's all very confusing? Okay. Good. At least we have one honest man in the audience. Okay. Okay. What? All right. Let's see. The next thing I want to discuss, which is sort of related, but going the other way. So let's say instead of v of t, we have x of t. We know x of t somehow. And you know, we could start somewhere, and you know, this could be going, you know, like this. Again, this is some motion. Okay, and let's say that we're interested in the initial position t naught, and then some final position t whatever I want to call it, t star or t final, doesn't matter. So I started here and I ended there, and then I traveled, went for a walk, went back and forth, you know. And this is how it looked as a function of time. So I can ask some questions. For example, what was my average velocity. Actually, this could be a little bit tricky because if I ask you what's my average speed, it does not necessarily mean the same. It's a little bit, language thing. So if you rode your bike, right, even though if you say you were going that way and you were always maintaining 30 miles per hour, then your average speed was always 30 miles per hour, right? That's your average speed. But your average velocity has to be calculated as your initial position minus if the final position minus your initial position divided by the overall time. So if you went to San Francisco and came back and were always going 30 miles per hour, you know, your average velocity is zero, right? Because but your average speed is not. Do you understand this little distinction? And I might have slips of tongues and mean one thing and say the other, but use common sense. Anyway, If I ask what the average velocity in this situation is, then it will be x of tf minus x of t naught, right? So this x here, this is x of t naught in this case, and this is x of tf, like that, and divided by tf minus t naught. It's just average speed, right? It's not necessarily a very interesting characteristics. We might want to know what our instantaneous speed is, right? As we are doing this, and we have such a strange curve. So how can we determine what our instantaneous speed is, or what it is? Well, let's pick a point here, okay, and ask ourselves, you know, what is the speed here at this point? Well, in order to determine that, we can take an interval again. Delta t. And we can say that the instantaneous velocity will be, so we'll call it v of, let's just call it v of t. And let's write the following expression and then see if it makes sense. So what we're going to do is, this is very similar to this expression. This is the same expression. The only difference is that to say that instantaneous, we take this time interval, not a large interval while the velocity was changing a lot, but a very small interval, and then we call that instantaneous velocity. So again, this idea that if the time interval is short, we can say that the velocity is constant. That's all it is. And then to do it mathematically correctly, we can take a limit of delta t going to 0. And if you're did I introduce derivatives last time? I did. If you're paying attention, then you know that this is the definition of the derivative, right? So this is just d x of t by dt. And again, this notation is actually, you know, a shorthand for this, right? Because what do we have here? This is the increment of position. We just call it d x of t. And this is the increment of time. That's all. Okay, so that's the derivative. Now, what's the geometrical meaning of the derivative? Yeah, so on this plot, if we said that we say that at a small time interval, the velocity is constant, so what is the graph of position with the constant velocity? It's just a straight line. And depending on the sign of velocity, it's either positively sloped or negatively sloped. In this case, we have negatively sloped line. If something is at rest, it's a line that's parallel. Right? Time changes, but the position doesn't change. So it basically is replacing this part of the curve with some sort of a line. And then you would recognize immediately that this expression here, right? If we draw this triangle here, and we have delta x over delta t. So this is just the angle of the tangent, right? The tangent of it's the tangent of the angle of this tangential line, because this again is our delta x. This is delta t. So if I take this divide by that, this gives me the tangent of this angle. Tangent of the angle of the tangential line to x to the, I'm not writing very clearly here, x of t curve. With respect, this angle is with respect to vertical. So what I'm thinking here, so if I have a horizontal line like this, right, then delta x over delta t will be zero. So the tangent with vertical, with horizontal. Thank you. Right, so then the tangent is zero, and if the derivative is very large, then it's a vertical line, and the tangent is infinity. Okay. There's a couple of other things I want to tell you. One of them is that acceleration A. Before I go to acceleration, that I would just want to say that I chose for simplicity the example of the motion along one axis, but if it's a three-dimensional motion, then it's still the same. So, for example, v vector is the derivative of the position vector as a function of time by dt. And the meaning, again, is the limit of the change of the vector when the time interval is small. So these expressions are all written in general in the vector form, and you'll have a lot of exercises about this. So velocity in general also changes, right? If you get in the car, you press the gas, your velocity changes. So there is acceleration. And acceleration is, so A is a function of t, is defined as the derivative of the velocity, right? That's acceleration. And then the acceleration can also change with time. So there is a quantity called epsilon, which is defined as the derivative of acceleration in time. And does anybody know how this is called? Jerk. And this is acceleration. You guys know everything. So that's good. So we move fast. Let's go back to our friend Galileo. Let's in fact, this is a good time to try to reproduce Galileo's experiment. But let's first do the experiment. Like I told you, I'm really against this method of exploring nature by instead of doing the experiment, just sitting there and scratching, you know, like the philosophers sometimes do, like Aristotle, for example, right? And so Aristotle had some life experiences, and his experiences were that if you take a stone, it falls like a rock, and a feather goes very slowly. And in fact, here it is. I have a coin, and I have a piece of foil. And, you know, if I drop them, you can see that the coin goes down very quickly, and the foil, which is the approximation of the feather, goes slowly. And from that, you might conclude, you know, if an object is light, it falls slowly. If the object is heavy, it falls fast. Well, do you know what? Does anybody know what will happen next? Mm-hmm. Is there anybody who hasn't seen this before? Okay, good. Yeah. So this machine here is called a vacuum pump. It sucks air, and I always like to say that at my house everything sucks except for one thing. Can you guess what it is? The vacuum cleaner, yeah, that's right. Okay, so I turn this pump on, and I will. Now I need to find a place. Okay, here's the place where we're gonna connect this, and I'm going to open the valve here. And I'm pumping the air. And I have a gauge here. Let me see. Is this working? Okay, here we go. There's a little gauge that shows me the residual pressure in there. And I want to make sure I take the most of the air out of there. Okay, I'm going to close this valve right here. Now I can okay. Well, you ready? And now, I'm going to open it. Let the air back in. Oh. OK. Okay. So, I will tell Roberto, the demonstration guy, that this is an applaud for him. Yes. That's right. And in fact, this is very funny. When you watch space movies, you know, there's this big spaceship and it's, ooh, you know, but there's no sound in space. But it wouldn't be dramatic, you know. All right. Let's go back and talk about Galileo a little bit. So, real quick, what we said that he had, this was the ground. We said that we call the vertical axis H, and there was this tower, Leaning Tower of Pisa, Torre di Pisa, and he was climbing up there and dropping objects from it, and we said that at t equal to zero, we had h equal to h0. This was the initial height of the tower. And then we said that if we draw what was happening with the ball after it was dropped from here as a function of time, let's say this would be h, the height, this is the time. Then at t equal to zero, it's h naught, there where it was. And then you would let the ball go, release the ball, and it would, you know, start moving. And then at some point, it would hit the ground. And let's call the time when it hits the ground tau. I guess we know what the result of Galileo's experiment was. He sort of has shown that all the balls, to a good approximation, drop with a constant acceleration. It means that the velocity of the ball increases linearly with time. Until it hits the ground. And the way we chose the coordinate of the velocity will be negative because the motion is in towards the negative direction of h. So we can plot. Sometimes it's really helpful to plot things so the time axis is common axis so you can compare. I see a little bit of a mistake because the v is negative, so what I need to do is draw this axis like this. And so this will be positive v, but it starts at t equal to zero with zero velocity because he doesn't give the ball any initial push, it lets it go. And then it goes faster and faster and faster in the negative direction. So it's something like this. It hits the ground and then it goes back to zero. So, we can say that V of t, in this case, is equal to some acceleration A times t, and that's an interval of time t greater or equal than zero and less or equal than tau. And A should be negative, right? Because V is negative all the time. And there is a standard notation for acceleration due to gravity on the surface of the Earth, which is that the absolute value, so we can say that A is less than zero in this case, and the absolute value of A here is called G. Small g. This is the acceleration of gravity. And as you will see experimentally in a few minutes, this g is approximately 9.8 meters per second squared. Now, if you are surprised about these units, an easy way to think about them is that this is meter per second, which is the unit of what? Velocity per second, right? So this exactly corresponds to this formula, to the definition of acceleration, meters per second per second. So it's meters per second squared. So that's V of t. And now we need to find h of t. Well, we already plotted this, right? So at t equal to 0, it's h naught, and then something happens. And what happens is the integral under the velocity curve, and this is the integral here, this is the velocity. This is a simple geometry, right? So what would be the area of the triangle like this? Right. So it's h naught minus, because this is negative here. So if we take some time t here, this time, then this is t, and this is at. So the area of the triangle is 1/2 t times at, so 1/2 at squared minus at squared over 2. G I meant here. Okay, so we know that at time equal to tau, we know that, sadly, h of t is equal to 0, hits the ground. So we can substitute it in there. And then what we get 0 is equal to initial height minus g tau squared over 2. So now we can solve this for tau. So what we need to do is take that to the other side of the equation and multiply everything by 2 over g and then take square root, right? And if I'm correct in my little mathematics here, is this is 2 h naught over g, and then I have to take the square root. And now, how can I check my mathematics? There are several ways I can check my mathematics, so please pay attention. One is I can go over the whole calculation once again, but if the calculation is long, it's painful, okay, and you can make the same mistake again, but let's just do some other sanity checks. First sanity check, units. I have tau here, so it's got to be seconds. And let's look here. So this is meters, and this is meters per second squared. So meters cancel. I have second square now on top, and square root is seconds. Good. Units are all right. Then the next thing I check, does this formula make sense? What are the limiting cases? Well, if Galileo was too lazy to go to the tower and release the ball when it was already on the ground, how long will it take the ball to reach the ground? Okay, that seems to check. Okay, good. So now also we see that the bigger the acceleration due to gravity, g, you know, the shorter the time. That's good, right? We also see that if the tower was very, very high, it will take a long time for the ball to reach the ground. So that's great. That's great. Okay. So that's basically the Galileo problem. So now, this is all very theoretical, but we will put this whole theory to a test right now. And this experiment here allows us to do this. What we're going to do, we're going to drop a ball from the height of 2 meters. Right now, if you don't believe me, use this meter stick, and then we'll have some exercise in converting inches into centimeters. But okay, well, from here to there is 2 meters, and what it will be is we're doing a little bit fancier than Galileo. We have a photo gate here, and the counter will start counting time in milliseconds. This will be time in milliseconds. 1 millisecond, milli is 1 thousandth of a second, and it will start counting at basically when the ball is released, and then this photo gate here will stop the counter when the ball reaches there. You know, photo gate, there is a little LED and a little photo detector, and when the ball goes and blocks the light, that's a signal that sends that goes to the counter to say stop counting. Okay, it's a very really good idea for any physics experiment is that you should know what you're gonna see before you do the experiment. So let's try and calculate what we expect if we drop a ball from 2 meters. Well, this is our formula, right? That's all we need to do. So 2 times 2 meters is 4. So we have 4 meters here on top. And g is 9.8 meters per second squared, so it's about 10. Let's approximate it as 10. So it's 4 divided by 10. 4 divided by 10. Okay, and then let's take the square root. The square root of 4 is 2, and the square root of 10 is 3, approximately. 2/3 of a second. 2/3 of a second is 0.66, 600 something milliseconds. Shall we put it to a test? Are you nervous? No. Okay. I'm nervous. Okay. So the magnet is holding the pole. And now? The ball did fall. That's good news. The machine didn't work. That's bad news. But we'll Okay, let's follow the instructions here. It's almost working. See, the electromagnet release is working. And okay. That's a good idea. Average of two trials. Okay. Ready? Here goes. Okay. So we predicted about 600 milliseconds, and that's what it is. Now, it's a very good idea to see if it's, you know, what kind of error we have. Physics is experimental science, so why don't we repeat it a couple of times and see what sort of error we have on that. By the way, in physics, a number is meaningless without an error. Sometimes when you make the order of magnitude estimate, you know, you assume that's the order of magnitude, you know, within an order of magnitude, or you sort of quietly assuming that you're doing a factor of two accuracy calculation. But you know, when you're doing your labs, let me just say again, in physics, a number is meaningless if you don't supply an error for it. It's totally meaningless. Okay, so 645 milliseconds. And not too bad, you know? It's like 0.1%. Let's do it the third time, just to make sure. Okay, good. So now, if you read anything about Galileo, and I really recommend that you do, because the guy has discovered the modern scientific method. You know, I think he's the most important scientist who ever lived. So I really recommend that you read. There are tons of books. There is even a book describing his daughter. And Galileo's she was a remarkable person as well, and had a very complicated story, and the Galileo's life is told from the perspective of his daughter. Galileo's daughter is the book I recommended. Anyway, his health was not good, and you know, it may have been really hard for him to climb all the way to the top of Torre de Pisa, and it's quite a climb, I should tell you. Also, you kind of feel very funny because the thing is tilted, and you know, you are in this room and all the walls are tilted. You have an interesting sensation. So the question is, suppose that Galileo got tired one day, and instead of climbing all the way to the top of the tower, only climbed to half of the height of the tower. Or in our little reincarnation here of the tower, what we can do is let the ball fall not 2 meters, but 1 meter. So the question is, if we have had 600 milliseconds, approximately 640 milliseconds, for the ball to fall 2 meters, how long will it take the ball to fall 1 meter? So we can turn to our theoretical prediction here. And if we take h naught and divide by 2, the time will go down by square root of 2. And the square root of 2 is approximately 1.4. So you can punch in your calculator here if you like. Or we can just, in our heads, divide 644 by 1.4. And we should get something like 400 and something milliseconds. So this would be a very good test of our theory of gravity here, right? Shall we do it? So we're going to take this photo gate, and all we need to do is move it up, and I believe... to make our math a little bit easier, let's divide the distance, our 2 meters, not by two, but by four. So let's let it fall half a meter. Then it's a factor of four under square root, then we should cut the time by a factor of two, right? So we should go to 300 milliseconds for a dramatic effect. Here we go. We place it, this is a half a meter mark. So this is pretty heavy stuff here, right? We say that we cut the distance by a factor of four, but the time will only cut by a factor of two. Let's see. Our theory is not really working very well. Yeah. I wonder why, but let's see. All right. Okay. Let's leave the one dimension and go to two dimensions now. Can you imagine? There is a professor. He's now a professor emeritus here in this department who, early in his career, announced that he's not going to teach physics on the grounds that physics is used for military purposes, and so he doesn't want to have anything to do with that if he's not teaching physics. Things happen at Berkeley. Well, the reason I'm reminding you of this or telling you this story is because the example we're going to consider now is extremely militaristic. It's a shooting cannonball, in fact. So we have the Earth, and the Earth is flat, as you know. And we have a little cannon here, and what we can do, the way the cannon works is that the initial, it releases the shell with initial speed V0. But what you can do is you can tilt the barrel, right? You can shoot almost straight, or you can shoot almost vertical, although you have to run very fast if you do that. And parameter we'll characterize by the angle alpha here. Okay. And we can ask all kinds of questions. Again, let's neglect the air friction and things. And we can ask the questions along the lines of, for example, what is the distance traveled as a function of alpha, and then we can also ask a question. Suppose we want to shoot as far as possible, so we are sitting there in our fortification, and the enemy is approaching, and we want to get them the furthest we can, so before they start shooting at us, right? So we want to know at what angle do you have to tilt the barrel to shoot the furthest, right? We can say it like this. Which value of alpha maximizes horizontal, maximizes the horizontal distance traveled? By the way, have any hypotheses? Okay, so this is a problem where it is convenient for us to introduce now a two-dimensional coordinate frame. In the Galileo problem, one coordinate h was sufficient for us here. Let's call this position, first of all, let's call this direction x, and the vertical direction we'll call y. And all right, I just displaced the axis a little bit, but what I want to say is that at t equal to 0, we have x equal to 0 and y equal to 0. And then I said that initially the shell goes with velocity v, like that. But we're going to play a very good trick here. We're going to say that this velocity has two components, one horizontal and one vertical. And so we can say that Vx. But we can write, let me write once for you in a scientific way that the vector V at t equal to 0 equal to Vy of t equal to 0 of 0, okay, I'm going to write t equal times y hat plus Vx of 0 times x hat. So remember, these hat things are the unit vectors. So I'm just this is just a vector expansion. So this projection here is Vx, and that projection is Vy, like this. And the V naught is a vector sum of these things. And we can immediately say from trigonometry, can you tell me what Vx of 0 is and what Vy of 0 is? How about start with x? Okay, can people who don't find this obvious raise their hands, please? Everybody finds this obvious. Good. Thank you. All right. So the trick I was talking about is that the motion in this particular case, the motion along x and along y can be considered in sort of an independent way. So we neglected the air friction, so the motion along x is going to proceed with a constant speed. There's no acceleration in that direction, right? Until the shell reaches the ground. Then it, obviously something happens. But from the time it is released to the time it hits the ground, it's moving with a constant speed, right? So we can write that let's say tau is the time when the shell hits the ground. So we can say that Vx of t is equal to Vx of 0, and then correspondingly x of t is equal to Vx times t, right? This is how the coordinate changes with time when we have motion with constant speed, constant velocity. And this is true for times between the release of the shell and the time it hits the ground. So we solved half of the problem, right? The motion along x. So now we need to solve the other half, the y. Now, in the y direction, it is almost the Galileo problem. So the Galileo problem was this. You take a ball and you drop it, right? And here we have this problem, but with a time reversal piece attached to it. So in this case, we throw something up and then it goes down. Right, so like the second part. It goes up, it stops, and then it goes down. The second part is the Galileo part, and the first part is if you had a movie of Galileo dropping the ball, right, and you run it backwards. So what you will see is that the ball that's on the ground all of a sudden jumps up, goes very fast, and then slows down at the top. Let's write it informally. So Vy is equal, so at just after the release, Vy of t, just after we shoot the cannon, we have V naught times cosine, times sine, sorry, sine alpha. And then we have the constant acceleration, g, right? And it's pointing down, so it's minus gt. So what's going to happen is, at first my velocity is positive, right? So the shell is going up. Then at some point, the velocity is going to be equal to zero. That's actually the point where the shell, this is the highest point of the shell. And then it starts to accelerate down, and that's the Galileo part. And then finally it hits the ground. So we can then also say what y of t is. Well, it's equal to, at t equal to 0, it was 0, so we don't need to write that term there. Or we can just write it if you like, y of 0, and that's equal to 0. And then we just need to put the integral from 0 to t, Vy of t prime dt prime. And this would be the integral from 0 to t, and then quantity V naught sine alpha minus G T prime DT prime. So who can integrate this? Yeah. Absolutely. So the integral of the sum is the sum of integrals. So this term is just a constant. So the integral will be V naught sine alpha t, and then we take that from zero, well, t prime, right? And then we take that from, actually, let me write this up. Hold on a second, so you can see that. And this means the limits. This is the upper limit and the lower limit of the integration. What you need to take this expression on the upper limit minus the lower limit. But this is kind of meaningless in this case because at t equal to zero, this is zero. So we can just simplify this like that. That's the first term. And then how about the second one? So we need to integrate minus dt minus gt prime dt prime. Right. So the integral of x dx, you know, is x squared over 2. So this turns out into minus 1 half g e squared, like that. Yeah, so it's 0, right? I set it to 0 because initially it was 0. And there we have it. So we can set it to, we know that y of tau is equal to 0. So then this expression at tau should turn to 0, and we get there's something that I don't like here. One second. Yeah, no, but still there's something I don't like. Maybe it's okay. So we get the tau. Yeah, that's good. And again, you can apply the things that we talked about before. Check the units. I think this is good. Then check the limiting cases. It's also good. So the distance, Can you help me figure out how to calculate the distance that the distance in the x direction that the cannonball travels before it hits the ground? Yeah. Good. So, but this is we'll call it x. Well, let's call it distance. Distance the ball traveled along x before hitting the ground would be d. Let's say, and this would be the speed v naught. Cosine alpha times tau, and tau is 2 v naught sine alpha divided by g. And incidentally, 2 sine alpha cosine alpha can be simplified if you remember your trigonometry. Yeah. So what we have here is V naught squared over G times sine 2 alpha. So this is the general formula. Again, we can check. So it's meter square per second square over meter per second square. So it's only meter that survives. That's good. Then it says that the distance traveled is zero when you shoot horizontally, like this. It's also zero when alpha is 90 degrees, because you shoot the ball up and then falls right back. And then it's maximal, clearly, when alpha is 45 degrees, because then this is equal to 1. And this is the distance traveled. Incidentally, I would like to mention that in this case, we don't really need to do anything fancy to for this optimization problem. This is called optimization problem. You know, how can you change parameters to maximize something? In this case, is the distance the ball traveled. What you can do is you can write the distance traveled as a function of alpha. And then, you know, if you vary alpha, d is some function of alpha. So where d is maximal, what's going to happen with the derivative of dd by d alpha? Going to go to zero. So a general optimization problem is you differentiate the function by the parameter and set it to zero. And you have to check that it's really the maximum and not the minimum. Otherwise, you're going to, instead of trying to make things as good as possible, make them as the worst possible. You know? Yeah. So I think that's probably all we have time for today, except if you have questions, now's the time. And good morning to those of you who were taking a nap. Jerk is the change of acceleration, is the time derivative of acceleration.
So is that the same as an impulse?
No.
How is it different?
We will talk about impulse. Impulse is something else. It's a product of F delta T. We'll talk about it in great detail later.